On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
But what about the promise
to build the wall and make Mexico pay for it? What about the promise?
There's no longer an onus for the candidates to take substantive stands.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
Apple desserts, today on The French Chef.
Apple tarts! My name's Olive, and I'm 5 1/2. Julia Child makes the best apple tarts.
That's Olive Bogue. She's KCRW digital editor Caitlin Schamberg's daughter. And as you heard in that clip, she loves Julia Child's apple tarts. Olive and Caitlin use the Julia Child iPad app to make the tart au pomme at home.
You take apples and you put them around the tart.
You are ready to put on the pastry. So I'm going to clear all the decks here. This is not an actual rolling pin. It's one that my husband made for me out of an old garage broom handle. And it really works very nicely.
And then put some glaze on it and eat it. I love apple tarts because they taste apples.
Olive's love of apples got us wondering just what goes into forming a child's eating habits. For some insight, we called food writer and historian Bee Wilson. Her new book is First Bite: How We Learn to Eat. Hi, Bee.
Hi.
What is the single most driving force in how we learn to eat?
The single biggest force is exposure. We basically like the things that we know, the things that are familiar to us, the things that taste like home. There's lots more going on. And part of the problem with the way that we eat is that we have all these memories which are banked before we're even aware of them as memories. Lots of memories about food happen in the first 2 years of life. Actually, even before we're born, we're learning about flavour from our mother's diet. There was an amazing experiment done where mothers-to-be drank a lot of carrot juice in the last trimester of pregnancy, and their babies were born with a preference for carrot-flavoured cereal when they finally took their first bites of solid food.
That's extraordinary.
It is. I mean, that's just one tiny example of one flavour that was artificially done for an experiment, but if you imagine that process being recreated lots and lots of times, and if you imagine also adding into that mix all of the psychological factors of what it means to learn to eat in a family and to be fed by parents who love us so much and are so invested in us eating particular things, it's bound to be complicated.
Yeah, I would imagine sometimes that love can go quite awry.
It can, and with the best intentions. I mean, almost every parent is desperate to see their child eat well, to grow, to flourish. But sometimes our very desire to make them do that gets in the way, and children pick up very quickly on the sense that we want them to eat things like broccoli with a particular urgency, whereas when we offer them a candy bar, it's in a totally different tone of voice as something wonderful and special. And if you could somehow reverse those things, it's probably impossible to do because these responses are so ingrained in us too as adults. But if we're just able to become a bit more aware of it and to think, well, actually, there's nothing innate in our physiology that says we're going to grow up and not be somebody that loves crunchy salad, as you've said you do every day. And I do as well. And I didn't used to be that person. The other part of the story is we can change.
That was going to be my next question, is how hardwired are our tastes?
They're really not hardwired. Taste itself, which is purely what happens on the tongue, those basic building blocks of sweet, sour, salty and bitter, that's innate and hardwired. Every baby in the world, from China to the United States, is born loving sweetness. There've been these tests done. You give a newborn baby a taste of sweetness, they smile. It makes sense because milk is a very sweet substance. Equally, we're all somewhat averse to bitterness when we're born, but these flavour preferences can absolutely be overcome if you look at the fact that the world's two most popular beverages are coffee and beer, which are very bitter. We're absolutely capable of learning to love bitterness. But when it comes to flavour, which is something that happens in the nose as much as in the mouth, all of our preferences for specific flavours, for the things that go into a meal, into cuisine, into cooking, those have to be learnt, because as omnivores, we don't know which environment we're going to find ourselves in. So all human beings learn their specific preferences for food. It just doesn't feel that way. It does sometimes seem as if we're doomed to be hooked on the kind of junk food palate of salt and sugar and fat, but that actually isn't the case.
Could you introduce us to Dr. Clara Marie Davis, who was working nearly a century ago?
Yes, this was a fascinating and quite famous experiment. It was popularized because Dr. Spock, in his original baby care book, mentioned it. Dr. Davis did this extraordinary study. It would never be allowed today because it would be seen as unethical. But she wanted to find out what children's food preferences would look like if they were freed from all of those social pressures of a parent or a doctor saying eat this or that, or watching other people at the table choosing certain things and sibling rivalry. So she took these babies, some of them were orphans and some of them had single parents, and she more or less kidnapped them, but in a good cause, and put them in an experimental orphanage where she controlled all of their meals, and all they were offered was a range of totally pure, unprocessed whole foods, ranging from beef to peaches to lettuce. And there was no comment made about eat this or not this. And she found there were 15 kids under her care. Left to their own devices, each of the 15 was able to choose a diet for themselves that was nutritionally adequate. They cured themselves of diseases like rickets. But equally, each of the 15 ate in a slightly different way. So this study does offer a fascinating insight into the way that each of us does have a unique relationship with food. But the problem with the study is it's often been misread, and people look at it and say, there's this thing, the wisdom of the body, that tells us what we need, and we just have to follow our instincts. But Dr. Davis herself was well aware that the single biggest thing she'd done was to radically restructure the food environment of the children. And she herself said that the real test would be to offer them a choice between processed foods, highly sweetened foods, and these pure, natural, unprocessed ones.
Didn't she also talk about something called the flavor window?
The flavor window is more recent. That's also very interesting. So it seems that between the ages of 4 and 7 months, there's a period when human beings are more open and receptive to new flavours than they ever will be again. And there have been studies done showing if you offer babies unfamiliar vegetable purees at 4 months, a liking becomes embedded much more than if you offer it to them at, say, 9 months or older. So this slightly goes against the current advice from the World Health Organization, which says have exclusive milk feeding for the first 6 months. This is great advice for mothers in the developing world where there are hygiene issues and where the milk the baby is going to be given is breast milk. But we know that in countries like Britain and the United States, actually the vast majority of mothers have given up breastfeeding for one reason or another, basically work, by 6 months. So by offering them nothing but formula milk, you're just giving them this monotonous flavour pattern, whereas you could be, not for the sake of nutrition, but for the sake of their future preferences, offering them tastes of a whole range of different vegetables, which should mean that when they encounter them as a recalcitrant toddler, they're that much more likely to respond positively.
What are the three basic ways of thinking about children's food and the attitudes towards eating that come with each one?
Yeah, we've really swung from one extreme to another when it comes to children's food. historically, for a long time, in the Victorian period, the Edwardian, and I would say this probably stretched well into the 1950s, there was this view of children's food as nursery food. It was something bland. It was boring. Actually, things that were too highly flavoured were thought that maybe they might be damaging to a child in some way. So that view of children's food was that it's something very nourishing. You should make sure that children are getting their vitamins and their nutrients, but you shouldn't be thinking at all about what a child actually likes to eat. And there were extraordinary things said. The main book on how to feed children in America was by someone called L. Emmett Holt. And he would say things like an omelette shouldn't be given to a child before the age of 10. And salad was suspicious. Fruit was suspicious. Then in the post-war era, there was this huge influx of new industrial kids' foods, many of them full of sugar and highly palatable. And the idea now is that kids' food is all about just pleasing a child, allowing them to play with the food. And it's as if we've just come from one extreme to another. And the middle ground would be the real way to feed children, which is probably their diet shouldn't be so different from what adults eat. Above the baby age, most children are really capable of just eating normal food. They're not small animals like pets. They are still human beings.
I remember as a child looking at adults eat things like very softly scrambled eggs or coffee or cocktails. And I would take, you know, little tastes and I remember thinking, I understand I don't enjoy this now, but I can't wait till one day I do enjoy it. Mm. So is there some sort of passport with food that takes a child into the adult world?
Well, there are a few passports. I mean, one, as I've said, is simple exposure, but that's often easier said than done because any parent listening to this will know you see the food that you want your child to eat. You see the child, you see the plate. Just somehow the business of getting the food into the child's mouth is sometimes harder than you could ever have imagined. But there are these new techniques called tiny tastes, which have been pioneered over the last 10 years, both by researchers looking into the question of how can you actually persuade a child to acquire new likes of vegetables, and by people running feeding clinics where they see profoundly resistant eaters, a lot of whom are on the autistic spectrum. And I've done it with my own youngest child, who's my pickiest eater. It sounds almost too simple to be true, and it sounds like something that maybe parents think they've tried before. But I know that for me, it was the breakthrough, which is that if the food being tasted is as small as a pea or even as small as a grain of rice, your resistance to trying it goes down. And you can suddenly put it in your mouth. I think it's partly the texture has gone at that level of size. And then it's possible to repeat it. And I found with my son, by about day 3 or 4, he'd be saying, can I have a larger piece? So that's one passport. I think another passport, there's this thing that psychologists talk about called learnt safety. And this is seen in apes as well as in humans, which is that if you can witness other people consuming food and surviving, not dying, not keeling over, not responding as if it's something negative, then maybe after watching this numerous times, you might try it yourself. And I think that's probably what you had with the cocktails and the coffee and all of those grown-up things that you thought, well, one day I want to be like those people.
It's so fascinating. So now I want to talk a bit about sort of the dysfunctional side of eating when we can't stop ourselves. Is it true that up until the age of 3, children have the ability to stop eating when they become full?
Yeah, this was one of the single most extraordinary things I discovered while doing the research. Yes, and this, again, as with our innate preference for sweetness, it's cross-cultural. It seems that if you offer a child too large a portion up until the age of 3, they will self-regulate, they'll stop, they'll eat just the right amount. And if you offer them a small portion, they'll eat the right amount, and so on. Above that age, this skill is lost and sometimes never regained. But an equally amazing thing to me, because we really don't talk about it like this, is that self-regulation, hunger regulation, these things can be learnt, even as adults, but they can certainly be taught to children. There was an interesting intervention where a paediatrician went into a preschool over a six-week period and used these dolls who had fake stomachs filled with varying degrees of salt. So the children could put their hand on the doll's stomach and say, this one is full, this one is very full, this one is hungry, and then compare it with their own stomachs at snack time. And amazingly, after about 6 weeks, they were starting to say things like, I'm not hungry anymore, so I'm going to stop, which is certainly a skill that many of us, even as adults, haven't mastered. Certainly, that was my problem. One of the reasons I wrote the book was trying to puzzle out why it was I used to be so unhappy about food. As a teenager, I was a compulsive eater. And now food is a joy and I am able to stop. And I wanted to examine how that could happen.
One of the things that I find about eating is that it is all these things that can be studied in a lab, but it's also such an intimate and such a social act.
Yes, appetite is a profoundly social thing. And that's partly why it is so hard to study, because so much of the data we have is just based on survey responses. And we kind of know that almost all of us lies a little bit, whether sort of intentionally or not, about what we eat. So it's really difficult to unravel. And you can bring someone into a lab and get them to eat sort of preloads of various foods and then say, are you hungry or full? And try to monitor the effect of protein. But as you say, the real business of eating happens in the sort of messiness of the rest of our lives and families and culture and so many other things.
You've said it's possible to relearn how to eat. How does that happen? How can our next bite be different from our first bite?
Well, it's not easy. It helps if you can start by not going about it in the way that we usually do go about it. And I include myself in this. In the days when I was miserable and messed up about food, I was endlessly going on diets. I was always trying to change the way I ate. But they didn't last very long because I associated diet food with a feeling of constraint and it wasn't what I really wanted to eat. So I think if we could somehow see the problem as being not how do I force myself to eat lettuce and broccoli and protein foods, whatever it might be, but how can I actually work on my own preferences till I get to the point where I would like to eat a big platter of greens dressed with tahini sauce and sprinkled with pumpkin seeds because I think that's something delicious and satisfying. And I know some people listening might think, dream on. I never thought I would become that person. Part of why it's so hard is that you're in the before stage and then the after stage just seems like another planet. But it is possible. I mean, the main way that you change is sensory. It's not really rational. It's not about knowing what healthy eating it is. It's not about having absorbed some information about eating five fruits and vegetables a day. It happens meal by meal, and it happens by somehow sensory re-education. It's almost like becoming a child all over again and thinking, I can experience this food in a different way. So yeah, the three big skills we probably all need to work on. It's different if you're someone recovering from, say, anorexia, which I also write about, where the challenge would be how to make yourself eat more. Or if you're a picky eater and the challenge is to just broaden your repertoire. But the three big things are how to recognize your own fullness and stop when you are full, how to enjoy a variety of foods, especially plant foods, and how to follow structured mealtimes. And those three things, they're really complex skills. We shouldn't beat ourselves up if we haven't quite got there yet.
China's rates of obesity are growing faster than any country in the world. Is it modernity that accounts for China's new weight problem?
I mean, it's clearly a lot of things. It clearly partly is modernity. It's partly a new food supply flooded with fast food, and it's been happening in a kind of speeded up way. Hence the fact that the obesity crisis is happening even faster than in the States. But it's not just modernity. There was an amazing research paper I came across that was talking about the role of grandparents in China fueling the obesity crisis. So these grandparents are often the ones in charge of the only child, the one child in the one child family, while the parents go out to work. And with the most loving intentions, they're overfeeding children, not accidentally, but systematically. They have vivid memories of famine, many of these grandparents. And what they remember is that Children who, in a state of famine, were chubby would then grow tall and strong. It was like a kind of security device to protect you from times when the food supply ran low. So they feel it's kind of impossible to overfeed a child. And if you have these traditional ideas about feeding children colliding with modern junk food and colliding with a system in which there's only one mouth there to feed because of the one-child policy, it's a recipe for child obesity.
Wow. That is just sad and powerful.
Yeah. It's really sad to think the extent to which our problems with food could result from factors such as love. And of course, these grandparents, they're not intending to harm their grandchildren. But I think there's something similar going on here and in the States with a collision between traditional feeding techniques, which made sense in a different context, and a modern food supply. So in the States, it would more be that clean your plate mentality, which totally made sense during the Second World War when you weren't quite sure how much food there might be. But now to say to a child, clean your plate, if you're out at a restaurant where the portion is huge and the plate is so much bigger, actually that isn't the way to keep a child safe. We need new feeding techniques and we haven't quite figured them out yet.
Bea, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Bea Wilson. First Bite, her fascinating new book, explores the roots of our eating habits. Find out more about the book and get a recipe for Julia Child's tarte au pommes on the Good Food blog. So, what happens when your children refuse to eat? That's next when our show continues. Stay close.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Much like walking and talking, eating's a developmental process. But what happens when your child can't or won't eat? Enter Dr. Mitchell Katz. He's director of the Children's Multidisciplinary Feeding Program at the Children's Hospital of Orange County. Hi, Mitchell.
Hi, Evan.
It probably is going to be a surprise for some people that eating doesn't just spring upon us fully formed.
Well, as you said in the introduction, it is a developmental process that we take for granted. We put the breast to the baby or a bottle to the baby, and we accept the fact that the baby's going to suck and is going to nourish themselves. At about 6 months, when solid foods are introduced, it's fun. We have a good time. But there are times when, because of medical interventions, illness, or even poorly diagnosed or described sensory problems develop that interfere with this progress, and that's when trouble begins.
The children you work with have extreme eating challenges and are not just your typical picky eater. Can you describe some of the conditions that qualify a child for the program?
About 75% of the children that we work with are dependent on feeding tubes to receive their nourishment. The other 25% are on a bizarre concoction of Monster Mash that is not typical for their age. And these children struggle or are locked in a behavioral pattern that the parents are just lost and have difficulty breaking them of that process.
The children that are on feeding tubes, are some of them on tubes because they actually just couldn't bring themselves to eat?
Well, the vast majority of these children have undergone complex medical conditions that interfered with their ability to progress in their eating. And as that goes on, they become aversive or defensive about eating. And in the need to provide nourishment, they wind up getting feeding tubes of some sort.
So what is the parent's role in teaching a child to eat, and how does your team guide parents away from feeling like they're failures at the dinner table?
Well, failure is the key. The sense of failure 5 times a day as you approach a meal with a child and they refuse to feed the child, or they are trying anything they can figure out to get nourishment into this child's mouth, or they are faced with having to give a child a tube feeding, which no baby book prepares you for. It is a complex process that is individualized based on what the child's needs are and what the parent's needs and expectations are. But working with the child, working with the parent, setting the child up with a new relationship with food based on behavioral techniques, and really teaching the parents a new approach to the child, together, those promote a new focus on feeding.
Could you share some of the more desperate behaviors that you've seen parents develop in order to coax children to eat?
The one that immediately comes to mind, there was a parent who could only get their child to eat if the child was asleep. And the only way to get the child to sleep was to put the child in a car seat, drive 60 miles an hour on the freeway, get the child to sleep, and then pull off to the side of the road and feed the child, and then drive home.
I can just imagine what it must have been like to be in that parent's head.
Yeah, I mean, this is to the extremes of what parents go to at times to try to get the child to nourish. We intervene, and now the child's eating hot dogs and hamburgers.
I think when parents are so desperate, that sense of agitation and subtle discomfort must infiltrate into the child in a very profound way.
It distorts their relationship in ways that are incalculable to someone who is not facing that struggle. The basic role of a parent is to nourish your child with the basics of food. And having difficulty feeding a child goes to the core of being an unsuccessful parent, which this is not about, but this is what they feel.
So what happens during a feeding therapy session?
The concept that we use is, if not this, then that. In other words, you present to the child two options. Do you want to eat one thing or another thing? Giving the child some sense of control, because that's what the child is evoking, a control over refusing to eat. But here we're encouraging the child to take one of a couple of foods and giving them still the sense of control while rewarding them for making a selection. But either thing they choose is what we want.
How old are these children?
Between about 2 years and about 6 years, although we have done children as old as 11 and 13 years old.
Wow, that is a lot of years of struggle.
A lot of years. I remember one 11-year-old boy, he had been through a lot of complex medical procedures. And I said, why don't you eat? He said, I don't know how to.
Wow.
Can you imagine sitting in the room and listening to your child say, I don't know how to eat?
So how do you teach them to eat? It must be as much about the sensation of what goes on in the mouth as it is about flavor, which is what we all think about.
Some of our kids, the first thing they will want is the very savory, like hot Cheetos, which is not what I want children to eat. But because of the shock to the mouth, if in a sense their taste buds are numb. And so they can appreciate subtlety. They need sharp foods to stimulate their understanding that there's food in the mouth and this is different.
And does the intense texture of those Cheetos also come into play?
In some children are more texture averse, and we have to start with, say, pureed foods and advance them through the program and even beyond to broadening their texture receptiveness.
I understand that the treatment is a 19-day inpatient program. How quickly do you tend to start seeing results?
Within 24 hours. It's stunning. Oftentimes when I walk in to visit the parents on their second day, they already say, I've never seen a child eat that. And it's partially because they're dealing with people who have a lot of experience, but also because the child doesn't have a relationship with these therapists and can't manipulate the situation and avoid the situation, and the therapists guide the child. It could be just the child took a bite of strawberry that the kid never had before, and the parents are just shocked.
Wow. Do children regress or backslide once they leave the program?
75% of our kids, as I said, are tube-fed when they enter the program. When they leave the program after 19 days, our numbers are about 90% are free of their tube. After about 3 months, there's a couple of kids that backslide, so we quote about 84% remain off the tube. And it seems if you get past that three-month window, it tends to stick. The kids go on and remain off of the G-tubes. Of all the kids we've done, I would say somewhere around all but 3 or 4% of the 160 kids that we've done have benefited substantively from going through the program.
Do you see when children come back to visit, once they have real success, a different kind of relationship with food than a child who, quote, normally takes to eating?
We are honored and pleased to report that some of our children have received best eating awards in school and have gotten certificates to the same. It is variable. Some of these children go on and they are willing to experiment with everything and anything because it is a new world for them. Some children still struggle and have to work to make further advancements, but they do in general. Some children still seem to be somewhat stuck. It's not a panacea. It doesn't cure all. I wish that was the case, but it's not. But the vast majority of children are different when they leave the program and advance as they go on. And as much the parents and their relationship with the children improve as well. And they have a completely different focus with the children.
Is including the child in cooking or rudimentarily preparing their own food part of the therapy to get them to eat?
Not specifically. In my dreams for the future, I would love to see a program where we can incorporate not just this inpatient intensive program, but an outpatient program as well, that would include a kitchen, particularly dealing with older children who have various feeding challenges. It is my desire, my dream to have a whole, if you will, institute. But an important part of that would be a therapy kitchen.
Wow, so interesting. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Evan.
That was Dr. Mitchell Katz. He directs the Children's Multidisciplinary Feeding Program at the Children's Hospital of Orange County. In a minute, we get child-rearing tips from two dads I think it's fair to say are food fanatics. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe, Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. You can listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. If you listen to the show regularly, the two guys on next will be very familiar to you. Jonathan Gold is the LA Times food critic, and Peter Meehan is the editorial director of Lucky Peach magazine. Jonathan and Pete, you both have kids. How do you negotiate raising them as omnivores without having them veer off into becoming little miniature foodie nightmares?
I'm at the beginning of this adventure because my daughters are 2 years old and 6 years old, and your kids are a bit older than that.
12 and 21.
I guess I'll start by saying how I'm approaching it, and then you can correct the error of my ways from what you've seen. And then when they're all adults, we'll meet up and go back and see how we did.
I think what we both agree on, though, is that we don't want to have the kind of kids that said, you know, the foie gras this week isn't quite as good as the one that we had at Spago last month.
No, that's so true, but it's a danger of our professions or professional interests that your kids can't help but be influenced in all the wrong ways.
Pete, can you give me an example of what you mean?
Like, I'm not friends with a lot of chefs, but I know, you know, a few chefs. And Danny Bowen has a two-year-old kid, so we hang out sometimes, and we'll go to Danny's restaurants. And Danny will cook off-the-menu food for Hazel, make her quesadillas at the Mexican restaurant. She calls Mission Chinese food in New York, which has a wood-burning oven where they make great Neapolitan-style pizzas. She calls that Danny's pizza restaurant. My wife was in the habit of picking Hazel up from school and on Fridays, and they would get ice cream. So I picked her up from the bus, and I'm like, do you want to go to the ice cream truck, or do you want me to take you to a restaurant for gelato? And Olivia, the children's books, have gelato as like a recurring motif. So she's like, I would like gelato. And so we're walking over to the restaurant, Otto, Mario Batali's place on 8th Street and 5th Avenue, and we're walking up, and she's like, Dad, do we know the person who owns this restaurant? And hilariously enough, Mario vacations in Michigan near where my parents live. So Hazel had been to Mario's house there. And I'm like, yes, yes, we do. And we went into Otto and we sat in the, they like wouldn't let us sit anywhere. And we're sitting in the window eating this gelato. And then I hear Mario come out and he's like, Hazel, where have you been? And I'm just like, also, how did you remember my child's name? That just destroyed my brain. But then, you know, got a hug and, you know. So that's, I've already ruined everything for her.
Does that sound familiar, Jonathan?
Yeah, when my daughter was 6 or 7 and we lived in New York, which was just when Lupa was getting started, my daughter considered it a delivery system for spaghetti carbonara. And when you start at Lupa, it's hard to...
Right, it's a slippery slope down from there.
Are there certain foods that you require your kids to eat?
I don't try to get them to eat anything that they don't want to. I don't make them finish their plates usually. Like sometimes my wife will be worried that we're not feeding them enough vegetables or they didn't eat enough. And I'm like, you know, generally animals eat enough to survive. So if they're done, they're done. It'll be fine. They go through phases where they don't like or they reject things. But the 6-year-old, she just ate kimchi for the first time.
How did that go?
She'd seen it. And, you know, obviously kimchi objectively smells funny. And my wife had started like rinsing off kimchi, kind of, you know, the Korean mom move. But like Hazel now, you know, saw it as like a badge of pride, like I ate, you know, kimchi. And so she's proud of that and interested in the idea of spicy food, which has been anathema to her up until this point.
My daughter was a very good eater, but deeply feared chilies and super sensitive to the point where sometimes I would joke that she could tell when I waved a chili over a pot of food without it actually touching. And she had this supernatural ability of finding the one chili seed in a big pot of sauce and accusing me. It was correct.
Jonathan, you have this very strange life where you're eating out 100 times more than the average human.
Only 10.
But you're also the cook for the family.
Right.
When your kids were growing up, how often were you schlepping them out for meals? So they were getting dragged along, which I know is all children's favorite things. And how often were you cooking at home?
I've always had a routine of cooking for them and having dinner with them and sitting around and then going out late. Sometimes it's not possible, but I try to do it, you know, at least several times a week. And it's hard to be as interested in food as everyone in this room is without wanting to spend huge amounts of time in markets and farmers markets and cheese stores and butcher shops and seeing what's going on that way. And you have all this produce, you might as well cook it, right?
Do they cook, your kids?
They're starting to. Leon, my son, has definite things that he wants to do in the kitchen. I mean, he cooks the rice his way. I gave him the basic amounts. I showed him how to rinse it. But he has, favorites. You know, he likes jasmine rice better than he likes short grain rice. And he salts it a particular way and always plops butter in it. And it's really good rice. And my daughter bakes.
Pete, are your daughters interested in cooking?
My wife has always been a better cook than me. And in the last couple of years, I don't think I've officially been exiled from the kitchen, but I've more or less been pushed out. You know, I'm allowed to have like a weekend project every once in a while, but otherwise I'm good for dishes and shopping. But she's great with getting our girls, and they love it. You know, they put on aprons, they you know, like we make pizza, they stretch their own dough, and it's just a fun thing to do together as a family. We make jamuk bop, which is a recipe that's in 101. The first Lucky Peach cookbook is called 101 Easy Asian Recipes. And that was a dish I first had here in Los Angeles. And it's basically rice and ground beef cooked in, you know, that soy sauce, sesame oil, pear-sweetened marinade with some nori in there. But, like, making that and then letting the kids form their own balls, I don't know, it's just fun.
And there's something almost magical when you realize that your kids have made the salad, or that they're forming the ground meat around the kebab sticks for Kuba Day.
Do they become the taste makers of their group in school?
I think the other students at my daughter's university look to her for culinary guidance because they assume that she knows things that they don't. And she says it's a lot of pressure always having to choose the restaurant.
Yes, it is.
But then again, she also has the ability to make canapés for all 80 people in the dorm when it was time to have a party. And it's nice to have that ability.
We've been talking to Peter Meehan of Lucky Peach and Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. Next, we stick around with Jonathan to hear where he's dining out this week with or without the kids. Stay tuned.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, where are you taking us this week?
We're going to a new noodle restaurant by the people who brought us Chengdu Taste called Mian. Chengdu Taste is an astonishingly popular restaurant serving like modernized Sichuan cuisine. Very spicy, but with like different layers of chilies of different heats and marinations and flavors and smokinesses and stuff. This is using almost that same level of sophistication and bringing it to the famous Chongqing noodle.
Describe what the noodles are like. Are they an egg-based wheat noodle?
I think there's egg in them. They're definitely a wheat noodle. They're springier than you usually get in Chinese restaurants. They're not hand-pulled. They're handmade, though apparently not on the premises. And again, they have like a really nice bite to them and a really sort of strong flavor. I mean, not super strong, but I mean, you know that you're eating a noodle. It's not just something there to give thickness to a sauce.
Are we eating them in a broth or are we eating them on our own with the sauce?
It depends what you feel like. The main noodle there is probably zhajingmian. And we've talked about zhajingmian on the show before. Usually the Korean version, which comes with a delicious black bean sauce that's like motor oil in consistency. And I think we've also talked about the sort of like the Lanzhou style of, you know, hand-pulled zhajingmian, which are also good but are sort of less intense. Tony Xu, the chef there, does what he describes as a Chengdu-style zhajingmian. which comes with crumbles of pork, chopped scallions, and pickles, and an undercoat of really hot chili, a little bit of sesame paste. And then you toss them all together and you eat them, and there's enough of the numbing thing going on so it doesn't seem really hot. And it's not bothersomely hot, but it's one of the super good noodle dishes in town. He also does what he calls the Chongqing style. The only difference between that and the Chengdu style is that he throws in some peas that he's imported from the city, which are almost completely bland but have a sort of beautiful softness to them that I think makes a nice addition to the noodles.
That seems to be the noodle that everybody gets when they're there, but there's a much wider selection.
Yeah, there's not a huge selection. There might be, you know, 8 or 10 noodles on the menu. It's probably the place to note that this isn't a typical SGV noodle dive. It's sort of nice. The walls are dark. There's windows. There's track lighting in the ceiling that seems designed to make your Instagram pictures just pop. I mean, you check it out on Instagram. Every picture of the noodles in that restaurant is just beautiful. I don't know if that's an aesthetic that restaurants should follow, but some of the other noodles I liked are the hot and sour noodles, which would probably be the typical noodle dish of the Chengdu region. They're thinner. They're much softer. They come in a sort of a zippy vinegar broth. They seem lighter and they seem refreshing. I like the noodles that come with chopped gizzards. It's in a chili sauce. It's not super spicy. And the gizzards, there's always that hint of Thanksgiving to them, aren't there?
I love gizzards. I do. It's one of my favorite parts of the chicken.
It's a little chewy, but stewed nicely. It picks up the flavor of the sauce well. It's a special noodle. There's I guess what I've always thought of as the Taiwanese beef noodle soup, which is to say, you know, in a broth with stewed beef and vegetables. That's pretty good. And one of the ones I like the best, you probably would never accuse me of liking, but it's the washing egg noodles.
Now, what is that?
It's noodles in what tastes like a great fresh tomato broth. I don't even know how they pull it off at this time of year. And they have a chow show or dumplings, which are, for the most part, like the wontons with chili oil you've had at Chengdu Taste. They're delicious. But they have another one they just call pork dumpling that are like every takeout Sichuan dumpling you've ever gotten in your life, but somehow utterly delicious. You know, the sauce of, you know, chili, and there's vinegar, there's tons of garlic in it, little soy. I don't know how it comes together like this. I don't know why those dumplings are so delicious, but it makes me, you know, regret the 1,500, you know, delivered Sichuan dinners that I had when I lived in New York.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Mian in San Gabriel. Text the words good food to 69866 to get a text that will tell you where to find all of Mr. Gold's recommendations. Now it's time for the Santa Monica Farmers Market Report. Let's see what Laura Avery has in store for us this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We are starting the month of April. It's spring officially, and one of the harbingers of spring is fava beans. And right now I'm talking with Michael Fiorelli, who is chef owner of Love and Salt in Manhattan Beach. Tell us a little more about your love of fava beans and what you're going to be making.
Well, we wait all year for fava beans. They have such a short window, so we get so excited for them to come around. And when they do, we'd like to do as many things as we can with them. But what we're making now that we're really excited about is this fava bean toast, which is great. It really features the fava bean. We toast the bread, we whip some ricotta cheese, and then we pair it with a little shaved pecorino, which is classic. And then what's really exciting, kind of sets the toast off, is we top it with some preserved lemon. So the lemon, the pecorino, and the fava is really classic, delicious, and so springy.
So fava bean toast, you've got to have the good toast. What kind of bread do you use?
Yeah, really, a lot of this is about the bread. So we use a great ciabatta bread. We get our bread from Larder Bakery. So we just toast it in olive oil so you get a really nice crunch. It doesn't get soggy because it's got that ricotta on there. The lemon and the beans are tossed in some good olive oil. So really important that the bread stands up to whatever's on top of it. And you have that really nice balance.
Now, when you're talking fava beans, you're talking about that great big bean with the very spongy, sort of beautiful insulated inside. Then inside there's the little fava bean, and then that's got a skin on it. So what is your process for getting all of those layers off of that bean?
Right. Well, it's triple the work. You have to take it out of the initial pod and then take them out of the second shell. You can lightly blanch them. It makes a little bit of a quicker process. If you do that, we like to take them out raw. You'll get a much greener, brighter fava bean.
Yeah, I had never heard that. I always thought you're supposed to blanch them first and then they pop right out.
They're much harder to peel, but what happens is they'll lose their coloring much quicker if you blanch them first. All the green vegetables, they have a little gas inside, which is what makes them green. The chlorophyll rises and that gas gets trapped inside when you blanch them in the shell. So to avoid that, if you keep them in the shell, it's a lot more work, obviously, but much brighter green end product. We do it all raw from start to finish.
So there must be quite a bit of time spent just prepping these beans. And I know those pods are huge, and out of each pod, you maybe get like a teaspoon of beans.
It's almost laughable and heartbreaking in the same sense when you have, 40 pounds of beans and you wind up with a tiny little container when you're done. But if you come into Love and Salt, if you look behind the line, you'll see all the cooks just peeling beans every free second they have for like all spring long. So,
right. It's very labor intensive, but that flavor of the fava bean is just like no other.
You have to wait for it year round because there's really no replacement for it. There's no fresh bean that's anything like it.
Let's talk sizes. So the little tiny ones you can eat whole or maybe 3 inches and under.
Right.
And then these big ones with all the spongy insides, they can be up to like 8 inches long.
Yeah, they get really big, which is great. And then when they get real big, we'll even use them for purees and things like that. It's really versatile. Fava beans are versatile. They have a great texture. They're very creamy if you puree them. So it's a great thing to have around.
Do you ever do anything with the leaves?
I'm so glad you asked that. We love the leaves because a lot of people don't realize with vegetables like fava beans, a lot of the nutrients or more of the nutrients are actually in the stems and the leaves. So right now we put them on a pizza actually because they cook really well. There's not a lot of water in them, so you can throw them in the oven too. So we make a pizza, we put them right on top and cook them right in the oven. But you can saute them, eat them raw in salads. They're great and they're delicious.
And the stems are tender enough to eat?
If they're really big, we'll discard them, we'll take them off, but the small tender ones we'll leave right on there. Yep.
Okay, great. Well, that sounds fantastic. That was Michael Fiorelli. He is chef owner of Love and Salt in Manhattan Beach. He is one of the people who just goes crazy for the fava beans in the spring. And he's got a fantastic recipe that he's going to be rocking as long as we got fava beans. One of the farmers who's selling fava beans at the market is Valdivia Farm from Carlsbad down in San Diego County. And I'm talking now with Francisco Garcia, who works with the farm. And Francisco, you're the farmer. You're growing these fava beans. Can you tell us when you first start planting them? Tell us a little bit about how long they take to grow and how many times you have to plant them throughout the year.
We start planting around October, and then we try to do maybe like 2 or 3 more plantings so we can have a longer crop. And then they usually take around 3 to 4 months to start producing, depending on the weather. They do well in like cold temperatures. That's why it's good to plant them like in October.
You've got all the leaves here. You call them the tendrils. They're really dense. And how big do the plants get?
The plants get pretty big. They can get anywhere from about 3 to 5 feet sometimes. Yeah, depending.
And I see the tendrils you have today. They've got a lot of blooms on them too.
Yeah, well, that's just the fava beans just starting to grow on the plants. But since we pick them for tendrils, we just bring the flowers with the tendrils.
And how long are you going to have them?
1.5 more months.
So into June?
Yeah, probably about into June, yeah.
That was Francisco Garcia, and he's one of the farmers at Valdivia Farm down in Carlsbad, California. And he's talking about how fava beans take 3 months to mature and bring to the market. For The Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
You can find Michael Fiorelli's recipe for fava bean toast on the Good Food blog. Now, we close out the show with something you adults might like after the kids finally go to sleep, a stiff drink being made from local ingredients. Here's KCRW's Jonathan Bastian.
The Good Lion Bar in downtown Santa Barbara is usually packed on a Friday night with 20 and 30-somethings drinking craft cocktails. That's where I meet 25-year-old Camille Fenton, checking out the bottles of liquor behind the bar. It's definitely not your normal stuff.
I don't recognize most of the names. I think the one that was weirdest to me was to see vodka made in Sonoma. I mean, I know like the best vodka is made in Russia, but I would be open to trying ones made in California.
Like Camille, more and more people are open to trying local spirits. In 2005, there were only about 10 craft distilleries in the state. Now, there are nearly 80. The industry has seen a particular boom in just the past couple of years. One recent study estimated that nationally, craft distiller sales went up about 35% between 2014 and 2015. To understand what's behind this movement, I took a trip to Ventura Spirits, a micro distiller in the city of Ventura, just north of Los Angeles. Located in the basement of a steely industrial complex, Ventura Spirits is a two-man operation. Co-founder Henry Tarmey gives me a tour as fresh vodka circulates through a pot still. Then there are the strawberries. They're piled into about 35 waist-high plastic barrels.
So we're looking at strawberries that are all grown on the Central Coast here in California. And this is all number two fruit that for a variety of reasons, it was overripe. Somehow it couldn't make it to the shelf, which is a great place for us to step in as a distillery because we don't care how a strawberry looks. It just needs to be ripe and we need the sugar from it.
Working with local ingredients is what Tarmey believes separates Ventura Spirits from larger corporate producers. Instead of just trying to make a bourbon that tastes like a Kentucky bourbon or a vodka that tastes like a Russian vodka, they want to make a spirit that tastes like Ventura.
I guess it's just more interesting to us to try to create new flavors. And the obvious way to do that is to root our approach to distilling closely in the region that we are.
The clearest example is a spirit they make called Wilder Gin. To collect the ingredients, they walk out into the neighboring hillside and pick naturally growing sages and herbs like California Bay Laurel and Yerba Santa and then add it to the drink. But can you really taste these local specific flavors in a 90-proof gin? To find out, I return to the Good Lion on a quiet afternoon. Here's the bar owner, Brandon Restaino.
You absolutely can. In the case of specifically Ventura Spirits, yeah, the Wilder Gin tastes like a California hike in the Central Coast. And we taste, you know, local sage and some of those other really interesting ingredients.
Restaino has seen the spirit and cocktail world transform in the last 20 years. In the mid-90s, he says bartenders rarely worked with local ingredients, juices or syrups, let alone alcohol.
The rise of the craft distilleries, to me, goes hand in hand with the focus on seasonal local ingredients across the country and the world. And just like, in our opinion, all local and seasonal foods, they taste better. And the spirits, if they're being produced in a similar way, similar philosophies, then you're going to get a great taste profile.
Even with recent momentum, craft distillers only occupy 1 to 2% of the larger spirits market. In comparison, craft brewers occupy around 10%. But there's been some good recent news for distillers here in California. In the past, these distilleries had to sell their products at lower prices to liquor distribution companies, which in turn sold them to liquor stores. However, just this last year, the state legislature passed a bill allowing craft distillers to sell directly to consumers. And cutting out the middlemen means the ability to sell bottles at higher prices. On top of that, they will also be allowed to open up public tasting shops. Imagine that. Instead of a day driving out of town to sip a Cabernet at your favorite winery, you may soon be taking a trip to sip gin at your new favorite distillery. For KCRW, I'm Jonathan Bastian.
If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com, via iTunes, or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food On Demand on KCRW's mobile app. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. That's Abby Fentress-Swanson, Laurel Garcia, Camille Yitze, Joseph Stone, Jillian Ferguson, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.